Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to the film scene. This is nothing. We're at the halfway mark. The movie Alive lasted 4 months. That was 4 months.
That's a great point. It was four.
Living on a mountain, and there was no cell phones. We didn't make cell phones. There was no cell phones yet.
So we're too deep. We got two more? Is that what you're saying? Two to go?
Yeah, this is nothing. I know people, everybody's freaking out, but it was like, you know, what happened to all the enthusiasm we had? We're going to write the great book and the great, you know, do a great painting. So everyone needs to chillax, as they say.
Everyone needs to calm down, but we're here and we're excited.
Jeff is busy on helping out Maria Menounos, right, with another guest.
That's right.
So he may pop in later, but today we have Ryan. Ryan, you've co-hosted with me before.
Yes, it is a pleasure as always. Senior producer of Popcorn Talk. We might get that cameo from Jeff later, but we'll have to see.
Who needs him, Ryan? Who needs him?
Yeah, forget him.
He's adios. So we're going to take some questions. Before we do, a couple things. I wanted to acknowledge the passing of a credible actress who we had on the podcast named Shirley Knight. She was really great. She'd been nominated for an Academy Award for a film called Dark at the Top of the Stairs, but she chose to go back to New York and work on theater. If anyone wants to see her in one of my favorite film performances, it is Francis Ford Coppola's movie The Rain People with James Caan, and she is absolutely incredible in that film. But if people want to go to our archives, because she didn't give a lot of interviews, she gave a very, very in-depth interview about her days back working in New York with the Actors Studio and all sorts of great films that she worked on. So Shirley Knight. The other thing that I wanted that is very topical, I normally don't do topical stuff, right, but this freaked me out. Apparently the Nordic countries, I was reading in Variety, the Nordic countries, Sweden, they're going back to, I worked in Sweden,
yes,
they're going back to work with extreme restrictions on going back to work.
Oof. So, I don't know how to feel about this. The article goes in detail what they are allowed and not allowed to do and this the depths they're going to, but so it just seems a little
early. Number one, no, which is what I said a month ago. People were making fun of me. No kissing, no sex scenes, no crowd scenes, meaning there's going to be no extras. You know, I was thinking of Goliath, you know, when I shot Goliath, the whole set was a casino. So... Right. So the writers will have to go through the script and there can only be, 10 people in the scene.
Yeah.
So isn't that going to be sort of strange?
I think it's going to be really odd. We're going to get a bunch of films that just have these restrictions on them. So I feel like we're going to get a lot of similar types of settings, a lot more quieter stories that are focused on just like one or two characters.
Two people in a room.
It's unusual. I mean, can you think of a blockbuster that has no crowd scenes?
I just think, can't there be a better way? Can't they filter the air or do something? I don't know. So there's that. Then the other thing that's even more precarious, two things that really caught my eye. If you were 70 and over, you can't work.
Right. They have an age limit now.
Is that going to be an issue where they're going to say, oh, gee, I'm sorry, you're in the risk zone, and then you could have maybe risk a lawsuit. Somebody could sue you for discrimination.
I mean, there's a lot, I think, going into this story. On the one hand, is it too early for them to even be doing this again?
Yes.
Filmmakers were so rigorous and will go from the ground to get anything made, whether it's like with no money at all or you're borrowing money. But with these limitations, it's only in our nature to try and make things.
Yeah.
So I think first and foremost, is it safe enough to even be to continue the filmmaking? And then second, you have these restrictions on them. Are these temporary or is this going to be permanent moving forward?
It seems a little early. The other thing that caught my eye, which, again, I had mentioned this months ago, they're only allowing a crew of 50 people. So which 50 people get chosen?
It's such a good question. What came to my mind is, you know, Disney Plus, they just had The Mandalorian come out, and they're releasing a whole docuseries on the making of it. And you just see in the background hundreds of people working on the film, not even extras, hundreds of just set designers, workers, lighters, gaffers. You got 50 people on a big feature film. It really is now a bare bones crew.
Yeah, you're doing an indie feature, you know. So there's a lot of issues with that. So that kind of caught my eye. I mean, you know, they're the canary in the coal mine. What's going to happen here? Okay, let's answer some questions. I got some great questions here.
A ton from Twitter, guys. By the way, you can follow Ileana at Ileana Rama on Twitter, and also Popcorn Talk at The Popcorn Talk.
And also on Instagram. So a couple here. Your favorite film role, definitely Grace of My Heart, I would have to say, with director Alison Anders' musical. All I think of now, Ryan, is like, oh, filled with crowds. A movie you couldn't do anymore because it's filled with crowds.
Remember when there were crowds in movies.
But I loved Grace of My Heart. I also love To Die For, another incredible movie. Movie of mine I really love called Search and Destroy. It seems to be a lost movie. I don't know where it is or how you can find it. I think you can buy a DVD of it, but that's kind of a lost film of mine I really love.
That was A1 Collect asking that on Twitter.
A1 Collect. Peter DiLorenzo asking me, were you aware that To Die For was going to be a great film? Yes, I mean, I was, because it was based on the book by Joyce Maynard. So I read the book and very much wanted to be a part of it. And somebody's actually doing their story that's going to be coming out about the history of To Die For.
Oh, wow.
So I participated in that. So I gave them a lot of inside deep cuts, as I like to call them.
Interesting. I can't wait to see it.
This is unusual, but I actually have an answer. Nick at Protect. Protect the
NHS, asking, what is your favorite cheese? Not American cheese, which is an abomination in parentheses, which I don't feel the same. Mick Protect, but Ileana, what is your favorite cheese?
My favorite cheese is Munster cheese. It's like the forgotten cheese. It's got a funny name. I don't know why it's called Munster, like the Munsters. But
Munster, yeah.
I believe that Munster cheese makes the best grilled cheese. And there was I did a short comedy film, you know, back when the internet was starting.
Oh yeah.
Places would they'd give you money and you'd make little short films, and believe it or not, I think it was a mattress company or something like that. I don't know, they gave us money to do. We shot in the show in a hotel. And I made a little, I did a little short movie, and I put that joke in there about Munster cheese being the forgotten cheese. So that is,
Munster.
Yeah. Pity the, you'll see, you got to try it. Pity the Backseat asks, who would you like to work with in the future? And who would you have loved to have worked with in the past? Oh my God. Well, starting in the past, Billy Wilder, I guess I would say. I would have loved to have worked with my grandfather. That would have been, you know, pretty incredible. Yeah. I think that, but any, you know, working with Billy Wilder, I doing a comedy with Billy Wilder seems like that would have been pretty incredible. Jack Lemmon, I would have loved to have worked with. My God, he was incredible. And for right now, probably for me, if I, you know, Alexander Payne is my favorite director. I've said this many times. I'd love to be in an Alexander Payne movie.
Wow. You share that with Jeff. That's also Jeff's favorite.
And I love Albert Brooks. I've always loved Albert Brooks. I'd love to interview him sometime. We've met a couple times, and I just think he's a genius. So I'd love to, you know, he'd be somebody I would absolutely love to work with. Okay, if you had, this is Mick, he's already, you already asked me a question, if you, but he, so I'm going to skip the second one. Has the name Ileana ever annoyed you? No, not really. But, you know, when I'm on a movie set, people call me ID. I find that to be, you know, to be sort of entry, you know, a little bit of a good nickname.
He has a lot of questions.
My God, Mick, get a life here.
Like
Jesus.
Seven questions here. What is your, this is, oh, this is a great one from Mick, though. Your favorite, what? The favorite country you've worked in.
Oh, Sweden. We were just mentioning Sweden.
There you go.
Sweden was one of the great places. I worked in Italy. That was a little chaotic. But working in Sweden, oh my God, with Lena Olin, we did the show, which is called Welcome to Sweden, which I believe is on Amazon Prime. You can watch it on Prime. Right. But I love... People in Sweden have such a great philosophy, except when it comes to making their new except for their new COVID restrictions. But I loved working in Sweden.
Wonderful. I think we got one from Adam Ellis asking, has any network TV show in the years since come close to the quality that was in Homicide?
You know, Homicide was, God, the good, great question. Way, way ahead of its time. That was a Barry Levinson show, if people want to check it out, that shot on location in Baltimore. And I have a funny story about that. I was friends with Fisher Stevens, fantastic actor who pops up in movies and also a producer of films. And I got asked to be in this thing. And somehow we both got asked. It was like, well, I'll do it if you do it. It wasn't like a very big part. And we were, so Fisher and I took the train from New York to Baltimore, and we got down there, and it was a night shoot, and they were very delayed. So they said, we're not going to need you for like 4 hours. So Fisher and I went and got an incredible seafood dinner and had many, many beers. And by the time we shot, we were pretty drunk.
I love Fisher Stevens. That little documentary he did on Carrie Fisher, I think Bright Lights, was really, really nice.
Yeah, Fisher is such a talented person, and that was a lot of fun to do, to, you know, to have that experience working with him. There was another question. Somebody had written about the movie The Candidate. This Scott Schaumburg writes, Ileana Rama talks about Robert Redford wanting to learn more about Melvin Douglas. In my book, I blame Dennis Hopper. So this is airing tonight on The Candidate. And the story behind that was that I'd auditioned for a part in the movie The Quiz Show, and I didn't get the part. And then Robert Redford asked me to do this smaller part, playing Ray Fiennes' girlfriend. And it ended up getting cut from the movie. You can sort of see me. But I had a couple scenes, and it was really fun to shoot with Ray Fiennes. My God, incredible actor. But the day we were going to shoot, he asked me to his trailer, and he spent like 2 hours talking to me about The Candidate. And people were coming to the trailer like, Bob, we really need to go. You know, and I felt horrible, like, you know, because they kept looking in like, this girl's got this tiny part. Like, what is she taking Redford's time for?
Wow.
Today, you know? And he wanted to tell me about how much that my grandmother's political campaign had brought him into politics. And that's why he wanted my grandfather in the movie. And, it was unbelievable. I had them all to myself. I couldn't believe it. So one-on-one with Robert Redford, chatting. He could not have been nicer, more relaxed. Meanwhile, there's 300 people outside his trailer waiting to do this scene. And he was cool as a cucumber.
Remember when sets had 300 people?
Well, yes, again, once again, I was a huge, that's all I'm thinking about now, a huge crowd scene that we were shooting. And another little inside bit about Quiz Show. So I go to do the scene and, you know, I'm sitting there with Ray Fiennes. He had just shot a little movie called Schindler's List. Mm.
Heard of it.
I've never heard of it. Yeah. So he was telling me about that film.
You know? Wow.
Oh, sounds interesting. Like 2 years later. But anyway, so that's enough background. Any more questions or should we get to Alan?
I think let's get to Alan. Alan Rode. Alan K. Rode, who we have as a guest today.
We'll ask more questions next week. And Mick, come on. Did you drink too much coffee today or what? What's going on? Let's get to Alan.
Here we go. Here comes Alan K. Rode.
All right, Alan.
Film historian. Oh, pulling out the book.
Look at this book. Look at how thick it is, people.
Oh, Michael Curtis. Book. Alan, how are you doing?
If I was having any more fun, I wouldn't know what to do. How are you?
We're doing
Hi,
great.
Alan. Welcome to the home edition of the podcast.
The home edition. And you're holding my book so nicely, cradling it there. Thank you.
Yes, I know. Now, we're going to get to the book, and we're going to get to your book, Tomb. It's like a War and Peace. We'll get to it in a second.
It doubles as a doorstop when you're not reading.
But before we talk about that, I want to ask, so what are you watching? I mentioned on the show a couple weeks ago that you'd sent me Trapped with Lloyd Bridges. Yeah. That was a lot of fun. Now, where you next had promised you were going to send me Too Late for Tears. What's that?
Yes. Well, that was the first movie that the Film Noir Foundation that we restored, and we were able to clear the rights and put out on Blu-ray. And that has a featurette, and it has my commentary on it. And it doesn't get any better with Dan Duryea and Elizabeth Scott. I mean, I know you're a Dan Duryea obsessive compulsive. But I'll pass that on to you. But what I've been watching, I've had like a stack of movies that keeps getting higher and higher because I never had time to do it. And now that I'm stuck at home, I'm like trying to watch like a movie or a show every night. Not really trying. I think we've all kind of become somewhat like Howard Hughes. You know, I haven't gotten my hair cut. I'm a hermit. We all have insane cleanliness phobias. You know, our hands are getting raw. The only thing is I'm still cutting my fingernails. I haven't let them grow out yet. But I've been watching a couple interesting films. One was 125 Rue Montmartre. It's a French film from 59 by Gilles Granger, starring Lino Ventura. And instead of Ventura playing his usual tough guy or gangster, he plays this very simple, honest, working class guy, that sells newspapers. And he gets inveigled into this Hitchcockian murder plot and so forth. Was very good. Another film that I watched is Come Next Spring. I see only the new films, 1956, with Ann Sheridan.
59.
Yeah, Ann Sheridan, Steve Cochran, and Sherry Jackson filmed at Republic in true color. This was Republic's version of color that was either a forerunner or a competitor to Technicolor or Kodacolor. And it's beautifully filmed, and it's kind of a Arkansas set in the 1920s, and it's kind of like an American version of The Quiet Man, with Steve Cochran coming home where he's had left and abandoned his family, and Sherry Jackson's his little girl who's in a traumatic accident, who can't talk, and Walter Brennan and Sonny Tufts and Edgar Buchanan and all the rest. And the other one I saw was... I don't know why I'm losing my voice. Rhubarb, The Millionaire Cat. And this is Ray Milland and Jan Sterling.
Yes.
And the cat inherits.
I know this
the
one.
Baseball team.
Yes. It's
wonderful.
I love that movie. And that's the cat who appeared in Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Breakfast of Tiffany's. His name is Orangey.
Orangey.
Not the most original name for an orange cat, but nonetheless. And his, to me, his set piece film, Orangey, was The Incredible Shrinking Man, where he eats, you know, the wife and everything as the guy shrinks and goes into the dollhouse. They find the cat attacks him, and they think he's been eaten by the cat, but he's really fallen down in the cellar with the tarantulas and everything. And
I love that movie.
Yeah, but Rhubarb is his really his starring role, and it's very funny, directed by Arthur Lubin, and a lot of people have forgotten about it, Ray Milland and Jan Sterling.
Now, are these all movies that you can get on DVD that you can watch?
Rhubarb you can get on DVD. Come Next Spring was I have a source for movies that will remain nameless.
Okay.
Whoa.
This person sends me movies or gives me movies when I'm doing a show like at the Egyptian Theater.
Yeah.
He will come in, and if I'm in conversation with someone, like if you and I were talking, he just comes and shoves DVDs in my jacket pocket and walks on. And then later I get home and I've forgotten about it, and I go, what the hell is this? And it's like some Lon Chaney movie filmed in Jamaica in color, and all this, the most obscure, unheard of, a lot of French stuff, German, all this other stuff. So my palette is wide. Come Next Spring, I think, was downloaded by someone in Paramount owns it. And the French movie, I'm not sure. It's a PAL format. And okay. I'm a two all region Oppo Blue player kind of person.
Oh, boy.
In my house. I have like it's insane.
Wow.
But that's who I am. You know. So anyway, that's what I've been doing. And I heard you guys talking, Ileana, about no more than 50 people.
Yeah.
And so no Spartacus.
Well, I know.
But a lot of CGI. So you'll have like two people in the set, and then you'll have all these people that aren't people probably. And I guess we won't get to see Alan Arkin or Mel Brooks or anybody over the age of 70 work. To be honest with you, I think a lot of this stuff is panic driven because people are desperate. The industry, everyone's desperate to go back to work. And I don't think anyone really knows what's going to happen a week from now, 2 weeks from now. And we just have to all hope for the best.
Yeah. Everyone's going to have their own, you know, system, I guess, but it was just caught my eye because
of course,
you know,
of course,
like every time I see a crowd scene now, or I go, well, I guess they couldn't shoot. I focus on
able to. And you're not the only one that wanted to work with Billy Wilder. I mean, the guy, I have a book. Somebody wrote a biography of him in the 70s, and Billy Wilder signed it and gave it to Bob Thomas. And a friend of mine who owns a bookstore sold it to me. And Billy's inscription is, if you like this, you liked Himmler. Best Billy.
My gosh.
Yeah, he was, I mean, I don't know if he would have been the nicest person to work with.
No, I think he was, but he recognized talent and he never, apparently, he always liked talking about his successes, like The Apartment and Double Indemnity. But he hated talking about like Ace in the Hole, which I think
it's
is
so
like,
funny, Alan. A lot of these old school guys, when you were saying that, reminded me of, you know, when I was hanging out with John Frankenheimer, and you know, it was before the resurgence of seconds, and all I wanted to talk about was seconds, and every time I brought it up, it was a lousy picture, you know, and then it concorded, you know, and I used to think, it's such a great film, but he didn't really want to talk about it.
Well, there's an interview that I found in writing about Curtiz when he produced at Warner Brothers. His first production was a film called The Unsuspected, which is with Claude Rains, and it's about Claude Rains as a radio host, kind of like Orson Welles. And in fact, Curtiz tried to get Orson Welles for the part. He was unsuccessful. But I think the movie's terrific. It's not perfect, but I think Curtiz wanted to make a kind of another Laura, and the film wasn't successful. And he's interviewed about it, and it sounds like he's talking about somebody at a funeral for his picture. Well, you know, a man can only make movies so long if they're successful and if you have one or two. And he just sounded so sad because he realized, particularly then, as it is now, if you make movies for a studio and they're not successful, you won't be making any more.
Right.
And that's how I guess they had to look at it, particularly back in his time.
Yeah, really as good as your last movie. So the last time you were on the show, we talked about the book, but now you're working on the paperback of the book. So what are some of the additions going to be?
There's not going to be a lot of additions. I was gratified that the University Press of Kentucky really wants to put it out in paperback, and it's not necessarily going to be enriching for me, but I'm glad because the price will be a lot lower because it is an expensive book. It's a big book, mm-hmm. and more people will have access to it. What I am doing is I'm writing an aftermath or a afterword, I guess is the right term for it. I talked about Curtiz's family, and his family tree would take a genealogist and drive him absolutely crazy because he had this huge family in Hungary, and then he had, I think, 4 or 5 children out of wedlock with 5 different women, one of whom he was married to. His last child is younger than me, and he was born in 1886, so anyone can amuse themselves doing that kind of math.
Wow.
But what happened to his family in Hungary during the war, I did not have a whole lot of definitive information about, and now I do. And there's a really heartrending story of what happened to his sister and one of his nieces, both during and after the war, that I write about, and also his family and trying to get them over here and the State Department and Harry Warner and all of that. So I'm adding that into the edition with some other stuff. So I hope people will like it, and I'm gratified that the book has done so well and it's coming out in paperback.
Well, he's such a fascinating director because, you know, he really needs to get his due, because I think that, you know, whenever we put the talk about directors in the pantheon of directing, he would never get put on these lists. But I think that these days he is, you know, more and more people are thinking of him. But in the old days, like when I was first getting into movies, it was like, studio director Michael Curtiz, and he didn't get much credit.
Yeah, correct. I think a lot of that had to do with the popularization of the auteur theory beginning in the beginning 60s with, you know, Cachet de Cinema and Bogdanovich and Schickel and their work, which was very praiseworthy. But this whole and Andrew Saris, particularly with his directors and directions book that a lot of film students used to carry around, like the consecrated Bible and all.
Yeah. Everything.
And I think a lot of that worked against him because he was viewed, as you said, as the Swiss Army knife of contract directors. And when you look at his films, and particularly when I delved into all the production records, he certainly did have his own style. But for many years, he had to do pretty much what he was assigned to do at Warner Brothers by Jack Warner. So,
obviously I read it. It's a terrific book. It's got all sorts of insights. And I think we even discussed this before. The popularity of Casablanca, I think it's almost overtaken Citizen Kane. I feel like they're neck and neck in a way.
I'd agree with that. One of the things I wrote in the prologue to the book was nobody really knows who Curtiz is, but we celebrate each Yuletide with White Christmas. We celebrate the 4th of July with Yankee Doodle Dandy, and we fall in love every time we see Casablanca. So,
wow. Yeah.
That was kind of my premise to.
What good writing, Alan. I love it.
Yeah.
It is interesting. I think, you know the names Frank Capra, William Wyler, Billy Wilder.
Yeah.
But a film that's talked about more than any of theirs is only Casablanca, but we never talk about the director.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and of course, timing is everything. He died in 1962. And that was right when this kind of what I call a renaissance of appreciation for golden age directors was beginning.
Right.
So he wasn't there like Raoul Walsh wearing his cowboy hat in front of a group of rapt film students talking about stealing John Barrymore's body and putting it in Errol Flynn's house, which probably never happened anyway.
Yeah.
And Hitchcock and Richard Schickel, directors and direction and all of that. So he wasn't around to toot his own horn for that following, you know, the generation of appreciation. So that has something to do with it as well.
Okay, so now I would like to see, so when will the paperback be out, by the way? Do you have
2021 is all I know at this point.
Okay.
That's all I know.
Some of the other projects, because again, we're friends, so we talk all the time. I know you're working on the mystery of the Wax Museum.
It is done. We, Warner Brothers announced it yesterday. And of course I couldn't say anything for a long time because
Warner
Brothers project and rightfully so, but Mystery of the Wax Museum was the forerunner to the movie House of Wax, which was a 3D film that Andre de Toth directed with Vincent Price in 1953. Well, Mystery of the Wax Museum was directed by Michael Curtiz in 1933, starring Lionel Atwill, Fay Wray, Glenda Farrell, and a host of Frank McHugh and the usual suspects from the Warner Stock Company. And it was the last film made in what was called two-strip or two-tone color by Technicolor. And it has a kind of checkered history. For years it was lost. And then they found a print back in, I believe, the 70s or probably the 70s in Jack Warner's personal collection at the studio. So it was rediscovered, but it was never remastered, cleaned up, certainly not digitized. So you were always kind of listening and looking to it, and it had that kind of Crispy Critters soundtrack. And
right.
So thanks to the... George Lucas, the Lucas Estate, and UCLA Film and Television Archive, Scott McQueen, the restorationist who works on all the Film Noir Foundation restorations. It's been beautifully restored. And I mentioned to Warner Brothers, Warner Archive Collection, hey, if you're going to put it out on Blu-ray, you know, I want in. It's Curtiz. And as it turned out, I got together with Constantine Nasser, who's been doing Blu-rays and restorations of horror films and commentaries for decades. And I got Scott in. And then I reached out for Victoria Riskin, Fay Wray's and Robert Riskin's daughter, who recently published a wonderful book about her parents. And we were able to film a discussion with her. So the disc that's coming out on May 21st, I believe, has a commentary by Scott McQueen, mm-hmm. commentary by me, and a featurette with Vicki Riskin. And Scott's commentary is really unique because when he was a teenager, he interview of Fay Wray and Glenda Farrell. So he went back, got those, and we were able to drop part of that into his commentary. So how many pre-code 1934 earlier films have unheard audio interviews with the stars? The answer is none. So right. I'm very excited about this. I think
That's something to look forward to. I've never saw this movie, and obviously I saw House of Wax. That's the one I've seen. So this will be
right. Well, that one, Curtiz, they were thinking of having him direct it, but they had Andre de Toth direct it. And the joke around Hollywood is only Jack Warner would pick a director with one eye to direct Warner Brothers' first 3D film.
I think I remember that joke.
Yeah.
The only thing, that movie is so incredible, except that there's one scene, I'm talking about House of Wax now.
Sure.
It gets ruined because all the, you know, when the guy comes out and he's playing with
Well, yeah, but 3D was a gimmick. 3D was a gimmick. It's like they even did a Three Stooges short called Spooks.
Right.
In 3D during that 53-52 phase, and you'd have like Mo looking at the camera, throwing a knife at the camera and throwing stuff at the camera and whatnot.
The other project you're working on is Sorry Wrong Number, which I just, you know, you go through phases where you say, oh, I've seen that movie so many times, I really don't want to see it. And then enough time goes by, and I happen to see that it was on Criterion, and I said, I'm going to watch. That was like one of my early quarantine films. Man, that is such a
quarantine.
Great, sorry, wrong number. It was, I was on the edge of my seat. I loved it.
Yeah, I think it's a terrific movie, and Stanwyck got her, I think, her third or fourth Best Actress nomination for that. She didn't win. She probably should have. And it has a young Burt Lancaster and a Hal Wallace production. And, all of Hal Wallace's films after he left Warner Brothers and set up his independent production company at Paramount had this certain really classy look, well-made, well-directed, well-shot, everything. He was a great producer. And I think the film is great. And there's a company called Via Vision in Australia that's putting out this digitally restored version of Sorry, Wrong Number. And not only is it features my commentary track and an introduction by Eddie Muller that he recorded years ago for this film. And I guess it languished somewhere in a filing cabinet somewhere. And this company has retrieved it, and so we'll both be on the disc, and that's exciting. I'm looking forward to that.
Oh, great. That'll be, that'll be fun, because that's such a great, I love listening to commentaries. I hope they don't stop them, because it's always one of my favorite things is, you sent me a movie recently, City of Industry.
Oh, God, yes.
I watched the movie, because I mentioned Harvey Keitel, and then you sent me the movie, which... I said, man, it's a flashback to the 90s. I remember
making
these kind of movies. But I watched the movie and then I put on the commentary. Sorry, it was a little, it didn't have any insight to the film.
Yeah, I didn't know anything about the commentary. I just thought you'd like the movie because I really like Harvey Keitel in that movie.
Yeah.
And his character is typified where he's like, just raising Cain, trying to get revenge on the guy that double-crossed him after they robbed this jewelry store in Palm Springs, right on Palm Canyon Boulevard, which was cool. And then this girl saying, why don't you call the police? He goes, I'm my own police.
Yeah, he's
my kind of guy.
he's the whole movie. If you want to watch him, Timothy Hutton is in it. It's a lot. I had mentioned to you, I said, geez, I wish that Stephen Dorff had played Harvey Keitel's brother, and that Timothy Hutton had played the lunatic, because I liked what he was doing. I liked what Timothy Hutton was doing, but man, it's of its time, the 90s.
Oh, it's very 90s. And you get Elliot Gould as a crime master. Whoops.
Yeah.
As a crime master in downtown LA working in Chinatown. So
right.
How wild is that? He shows up
very briefly. The last thing I was going to get to just before we run out of time is, again, I always like to tell people, kind of let them in on, working a process. And with the quarantine, I'm writing. I've gone back to writing my movie book. And one of my favorite things is because there's no one else to talk to or no one else was interested. I call you up. I go, Alan. I'm totally getting into Richard Quine. So
we're all members of the same classic movie tribe. You know, we have to hang together.
I got to talk to somebody about Dan Duryea. So, what are your thoughts about Richard Quine? Because again, I find him to be. I love Strangers. Is it Strangers When We Meet? Strangers, Comfort of Strangers, the movie.
I think he had. I really liked Bell Book and Candle.
I love Bell Book.
I love that, and I got to see Kim Novak introduce that. This was some years ago when they put out a box set. I think Sony Columbia, obviously that was her studio, put it out, and they had her. She was at the Egyptian Theater, and she talked about Richard Quine, thought highly of him. She thought much more highly of Jimmy Stewart. She loved Jimmy Stewart, with Vertigo and everything. But Quine was a very, very good director, and apparently he came to a tragic end. I think he ended up taking his own life. I don't know whether he was ill or something, but I thought he was very good, and I like his work. And I know you've been working or writing about Connecticut-based films, and that was one of them, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my God, I've been taking a deep dive into Richard Quine. His whole career in early television, and then working for Harry Cohn, and you know, that's what's so much fun about these, the writing is you start writing about one thing and then you cover all this other territory, and then you have to figure out what you want to carve out, take out, in order to make it a coherent little nugget of information.
Oh yeah, well, it's almost like a sculptor. You're starting with this big square of rock or clay, and you have to start shaping it, and you go back, and that's why it takes me, I mean, it took me five or six years to finish Curtiz.
Yeah.
And each chapter was like a mini book with a bridge to the next chapter. And as you and I discussed, you have to weave in addition to all the films, you have to weave in all of the stuff about someone's life and so forth. So it's not, and then he made this movie, and then he made this movie. And since he directed 180 movies, it was really hard. It was hard sometimes to do that. But yeah, it does get, you have to decide what has value, what doesn't. And sometimes it's like being King Solomon. You have to cut your baby and trim it down because you know it's too long.
Yeah, there's good, because there's like a fun little nugget, but then it doesn't really end up fitting in. And then that's why we all walk around with these crazy trivia facts.
Exactly. I remember about 10 years ago, I wrote a long article for Noir City Magazine on Phil Jordan, who's probably the greatest confidence man who ever lived in Hollywood. He had everyone fronting for him. And I don't know if he ever wrote anything, but he got nominated, won an Oscar for best original story for a picture he had really nothing to do with. Guy was an incredible operator. And I had this story about 55 Days of Peking, and I had a story about Paul Lucas and Ava Gardner, and I put it in. And then I was made aware, you know, that's a really funny story, but it doesn't have anything to do with Phil Jordan, so it's going out.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's what you have to do.
Anyway,
but, one thing I did want to bring up real quick is the Arthur Lyons Film Noir Fest. Put your bells on, and
I'll have my mask and my gloves. So I'll be
hopefully we will be beyond the respirator stage by that time. But it is scheduled for later in the year, okay, and I did want to mention that.
All righty, well, Alan, thanks so much for being on the show.
Ileana, it's always a delight to be with you.
I'll be probably calling you in 10 minutes.
I look forward to it. And thank you, sir, so much.
Alan,
I really
appreciate it, too. And I really look forward to reading the book just because, again, it's a director who I just feel like we don't get the spotlight on as much as we ought to with a film as big as Casablanca. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ryan. I appreciate that.
Thank you so much, Alan.
All righty. Well, everyone, thanks so much for listening. Thanks for the questions. Ryan, we never heard from Jeff, so...
We never heard from Jeff, so he is dead to us, and no, we love Jeff. We'll see him next week. But yeah, no, we wish everyone well. Please keep washing your hands. Keep washing your hands, and just be safe out there, guys.
Be safe out there, and as we always say, everyone's life is like a movie with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And, make your own movie. Make it a good one. Stay strong. Be creative. And add a little bit of love to the equation out there if you can. Okay?
Comments. Be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.